Good morning and welcome to New Books Network African American Studies. I would like to introduce you to Dr. Quincy T. Mills. That's who we have with us today, author of Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America. So, Dr. Mills, tell us a little bit about Cutting Along the Color Line.
Hi, Angela. First, thank you so much for having me on. Such a pleasure to talk with you about the book and to engage with you and your ideas and certainly move forward there. So the book, Cutting Along the Color Line, is a work that essentially looks to trace the history of African-American barbers and barbershops from the 1830s through to roughly the 1970s. I first thought about sort of doing work on this project when I was in graduate school, early in graduate school. Professor Melissa Harris Perry, she was working on her first book titled Barbershops, Barbers, and BET, Everyday Talk in Black Political Thought. And we were in Chicago. I went to the University of Chicago for graduate school, and Professor Perry was then a professor at U of Chicago in political science. And she wanted to do an ethnography of a barbershop, black barbershop on the south side of Chicago. She thought that if she had done the ethnography, if she had sat in the shop for a good number of days, that she might alter the space, right? That a woman sitting in the, a primarily male space might somehow alter the conversations. And so she wouldn't get the sort of rich data that she was looking for. And so being a native of Chicago, a native of the South Side, she asked me to do the ethnography. So in the summer of 2000, I sat in Truth and Soul Barbershop on 87th Street near Stony Island for about 4 to 5 days a week during the summer of 2000. And certainly that was the time that Bush 2 was during this presidential election. That was a time that certainly, as every summer, frankly, Venus and Serena were sort of kicking up the courts and doing excellent. So there was a lot going on nationally. And so as I sat in this barbershop, again, 4 to 5 days every week, there was certainly, as you might imagine and know, bustling conversations, folks coming in and out of the shop, some getting haircuts, some just coming in to say hello, some coming in to sell stuff, whether DVDs or watches or whatever else they were trying to sell, kids coming in and out of the shop, women coming in and out of the shop. And I couldn't help but sort of think historically. I couldn't help but wonder if these shops had been like this in the 1950s. I couldn't help but wonder if they had been like this in the 1850s. And so I went to digging. And so one of the sort of fruits of that initial digging was I discovered this, or not, I should say discovered, but came across this barber, George Myers, from the late 19th and early 20th century. So Myers was a barber in Cleveland, Ohio. And he owned a shop in the Hollanden Hotel in downtown Cleveland in the 1880s through 1933. And Myers was William McKinley's barber before McKinley was elected president. Myers only shaved white men, businessmen, and politicians in his barbershop. McKinley was one of them. McKinley's political handler, if you will, Marcus Hanna. Hanna was, let's just say, he was the equivalent to a Karl Rove at the time, right? So he was a money man. He was a businessman. He was a campaign manager, financier, and so he was sort of a big deal in Republican politics. And so Hanna was also one of George Myers's clients. And what was interesting about Myers, one, was that he only shaved white men in his barbershop. So that was something that, I hadn't really thought about before. Wow. It's not something that I expected to sort of to find when I was doing this initial research. But what was also interesting about Myers is that he was somewhat of a political player. So he was not a politician, but he was steeped in politics, and largely, I think, because of the politicians who came through his barbershop. And so when McKinley was elected president in 1896, Myers received a flood of letters from African-Americans in Ohio, but also across the country. And so these letters would say, you know, I see that your man McKinley has been elected president. Please put in a good word for me. I'm looking for a job as the recorder of deeds here in Mobile, Alabama, right? Or, you know, I know that you are close to seats of power now, Myers. See what you can do so I can get this job here in my local town. And so, you know, just by the sheer fact that Myers had shaved McKinley, black voters assumed, right, that Myers had this – had these connections, right, and could bestow some connections on them, again, both in Ohio and around the country. And so Myers, essentially, he has there's what, about five or six microfilm reels of his papers that are in the Ohio Historical Society, and that, frankly, was intriguing to me, right? Who was this person, this barber, who has such rich archival records, who was steeped in Republican politics in Ohio, and, you know, is sort of moving and shaking with the black middle class. So he was kept on a very sort of tight correspondence with Booker T. Washington, a little bit with W.E.B. Du Bois. And so he was, you know, in the thick of things, and, you know, so to speak. So I was intrigued by Myers, essentially, and just learning a bit about Myers gave me the indication that there could possibly be more George Myers across the country in the 19th century and in the archive, more barbershops that were like Myers's barbershop, and that sort of sent me on, you know, the sort of a long journey of finding out who these barbers were, how these shops were situated across the country, but also what we can learn differently about barbershops than we knew before. And so that was the sort of initial push into doing this research on black barbers.
I the power in the barbershop, that it's political, right? It's completely, mm-hmm. It turned from a place of community to a very political stance, this Myers. That must have been very interesting. So that must fit very well with African American Studies, your book. How does this? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So, I would say barbershops began not so much as political spaces and then led to community space. I would say that they began as and still are as businesses,
okay,
right? Spaces of economy, where certainly politics and community were interwoven in these spaces. So I would think of it less as a linear progression from, say, businesses to political spaces to community spaces. Okay. I think that all of those things were wrapped in up in each other from the beginning. Certainly they got played out differently depending on who was in the shop. And so much of the book takes on this long narrative of looking at the transformation of black-owned barbershops that exclusively groomed white men to shops that were peopled by a black clientele, right? Which happens, you know, roughly around the 1890s, 1900s. And so how sort of economy, politics, and community take shape certainly varies by the customers who are in the shop, mm-hmm. right? Which of course is why, you know, there's a, I would argue, a major difference between black barbershops and white barbershops. Yeah. I think because of the experiences of black people in black communities, vis-a-vis white communities, and white customers, you know, what they get together and talk about is going to be radically different. you know, the nature of it, the environment is going to be radically different. And so I think who's in the shop certainly make the shop. The shop doesn't make, shops don't do anything. People do.
Okay.
So the customers in the shop will determine, right, how the shop is organized, made use of, et cetera. Which, of course, I would argue sort of explains how barbershops themselves change over time, largely because politics, economy, communities change over time. So how does the book fit into African-American studies? I think certainly, you know, in thinking about the long trajectory of African-American studies and African-American history, one of the major frameworks that we've used to study black people, right, has been thinking about the resistance or the experiences with a racialized society, right, that cuts across gender and sexuality and class and a number of other identities. What, you know, where I would sort of place this book within the field of African-American studies is sort of looking at the ways in which African Americans have negotiated the trajectory of both segregation and willing congregation, right? And what I mean by that is there's a way in which we can understand, we can think about, potentially think about black barbershops as, you know, spaces where black men have used to, one, find jobs and open businesses, but also find space outside of the surveillance of a white public as a response to Jim Crow, as a response to racism, right? So finding that space inward. But there's another way that we can think about it, think about barbershops as part of a larger black public sphere, a public sphere that's not, again, a reaction to a white public sphere, but one that is deeply entrenched in black culture, one that's deeply entrenched in the notion of a willing congregation. And so there are few spaces that have remained black, even sort of after the dawn of integration. That's barbershops, beauty shops, and black churches.
Right.
Those spaces are still predominantly black spaces, right? Not a, you know, I'm not making the general, I'm making a fairly general, but fairly focused statement, right? So certainly there are some, you know, many black churches that have white congregants, right, and many barbershops and beauty shops that have white customers in there, right? So sure. But on the whole, right, those are still three predominantly black institutions, right?
Yes.
And one reason that they have remained predominantly black institutions, again, since "quote unquote" integration, although we can certainly debate that, debate those parameters, is because those spaces are rooted in black cultural production, right? And so, you know, folks weren't fighting to gain access to white churches because they wanted to leave black churches behind. Right. They weren't fighting to get access into other, you know, into, you know, white barbershops because they wanted to leave black barbershops behind. I mean, they were fighting to gain access to those other spaces because they didn't want to be told that they couldn't gain access to those spaces. But that didn't mean that they wanted to shun sort of predominantly black spaces. And I think, again, barbershops, beauty shops, and churches are a case in point to further that argument that these spaces are critical to the production of black culture, right? There are things that can happen in black barbershops that frankly won't happen in white barbershops, right? The kinds of conversations, the kinds of community that's going to take place, they're just not going to happen there. And so in thinking about how this book is situated within the field of African-American studies, you know, this is a very sort of quasi-local book, if you will, right? Okay. And so barbers and barbershops are, by definition, community institutions, right? They aren't national institutions. Barbers and barbershops will tell you something about a local community, right? A barber is likely to groom two or three generations of a particular family, right? A barber will sort of have his or her finger on the pulse of the changes that have been happening in a particular community. They know the people. They know, you know, whose, you know, grandson is getting into mess, whose, you know, granddaughter is excelling in school, whose grandson is excelling in school, right? Like they have, because they've sort of been there, right? Folks have been coming in and out of the shop over the years. And so, you know, barbershops will tell you something about local communities. And then barbers themselves, right? Those who, again, historically, right, are active, will certainly tell you about larger national movements. For example, during slavery, again, and this is a time when, again, most commercial barbershops, certainly in the South, I would say most, I say all, black-owned barbershops in the South, particularly, right? They, you know, the customers were all white. And that continued after the Civil War. And that's largely because white men didn't want to be shaved next to a black man who was being shaved, right? It would have smacked too much of social equality for them. And barbers sort of, you know, acquiesced to this all for, you know, and they got paid handsomely for making these kinds of decisions that today we would abhor. During slavery, many, you know, despite the fact that these barbers were grooming white men, many of them were quite influential in assisting African Americans who were enslaved but running away, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are cases where barbers would open their shop door after hours, of course, and allow an escapee to rest in their shop, but they would have to leave before, you know, before sunrise. And so again, right, there's a way in which, you know, barbers, because they had some sense of economic independence, they had much more mobility, and they can also, again, sort of contribute to some larger sort of national issues that were going on, not just during slavery, but certainly during the civil rights movement later in the 50s and 60s as well. So this book sort of contributes to our discussions of black businesses, mm-hmm. Discussions of black politics, of the black public sphere, and, you know, how all those things sort of intersect on a very sort of local level.
Wow, it's like the power in the barbershop, which you don't normally think of. This is a great study for African American studies, for history, like you said, for the thing that remains black culture. Mm-hmm. So my next question for you is, tell me a little about this cover, right? This cover is absolutely, it's historic because it's a black and white cover and it's a barbershop. And I'm pretty sure there is a story behind the cover.
Do you know who's in the chair on the cover?
I want to say I do. I feel like he is a jazz singer.
Yes. Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
so let me see. Is it Louis Armstrong?
You got it. Yes. So this is Louis Armstrong in Corona, Queens. So this was one of the barbershops that I used to go to. So the barber is Joe Gibson. Okay. And so this was Joe's artistic barbershop. And this shop was on 106th in Corona, Corona, Queens. And Armstrong lived, I think, at 107th. So it was, you know, right around the corner. Armstrong went to two barbershops. He called Joe's barbershop the Soul Barbershop. He also went to a Spanish barbershop, but he went to Joe's barbershop more often. And so this image And, oh my goodness, forgive me, I'm forgetting the date on this. This is somewhere, let's see, Gibson opened this shop in 1962. I think this image is around 64, 65, if I'm not mistaken. But one reason why I like this this image, and certainly for the cover, well, a number of reasons. One, it illustrates one of the major frameworks I have for the book. And so I think about barbershops with this sort of tripartite framework that includes sort of three constituents of people. One's the barber. Two is the patron or the customer in the barber's chair. Mm-hmm. And then three, and so that relationship between the barber and the patron in the chair illustrates the economy of the barbershop, right? That this isn't simply a community center, right? This is a business, right? And if these barbers aren't shaving or cutting hair, they aren't making money, the shop itself doesn't exist. And so while we like to talk about barbershops as community spaces, we can't forget the fact that these are businesses. And sometimes there's a way in which, you know, we assume that they are democratic spaces, but democracy is a process. Democracy is at work. And so barbershops are not automatically egalitarian spaces. It's up to the barber to decide, frankly, if he or she, right, is going to allow for that space to be an egalitarian space. And so and there's a way in which the economy of the barbershop informs the community and the politics of the shop. And so I like this sort of image here, one, because it illustrates that economy. The third set of constituents that I talk about in the book is this notion of that I call a waiting public. And that's the public who are folks who are in the customers in the waiting chairs, either waiting to get into the barber's chair or simply there to talk. And so, you know, it's that waiting public that we tend to associate with barbershops. It's that waiting public that, you know, engage in that sort of, you know, I would argue sort of fuels much of the conversations and the debates and arguments. It's that waiting public that, you know, will sort of come in and out. It's because of the waiting public, right, that, you know, many itinerant entrepreneurs will come in looking to sell stuff, right? Because they know there's going to be a group of people who are just hanging around who could be potential customers to them. And so the waiting public for me is a really sort of crucial constituent within the barbershop. And so thinking about those three folks together sort of provides this larger framework for what I argue sort of happens here in this space. And certainly, you know, thinking about the customer in the barber's chair, I mean, you know, this is a level of trust that customers have with their barbers, a trust that the barber is going to not jack up their fade or their haircut or cut them with the razor, a trust that, you know, this barber is going to remake them anew. There's a trust that, you know, the barber, but also the waiting public, that they will take good care with whatever information that they share in this space. And so, you know, I argue that, you know, in barbershops, black barbershops and black beauty shops, you know, black folks don't tend to shop around, right, for barbers and beauticians. Like, once they have found someone that does that, that they like, they tend to stick with that same barber or beautician. And so that relationship is really important. So this image sort of captures all of that. It has Armstrong in the chair. Joe Gibson is just right beside him. There's an older gentleman. And so it also captures generation. Mm-hmm. And so you have an older gentleman who's there, who's tipping his hat in some respects. You have a younger, middle-aged man who's sitting down. And you have two young children just sort of hanging around the space too. But what's also important here about this cover is – there's a little girl sitting in a chair in this image, and certainly in the shop. And initially, when I was speaking with the press, University of Pennsylvania Press, about this image, so they had initially cropped the photo, and so they cropped off the pigtail of the little girl, and so you couldn't quite tell it was a girl. And I sort of, it wasn't a hard fight, but I sort of fought to make the photo its original size, so that you can clearly tell that that's a pigtail and that that's a girl, to indicate that while barbershops, yes, historically we think about them as homosocial spaces, but women and girls have always been in barbershops as customers, as children accompanying parents, but also as barbers, as workers who did nails, manicurists. You know, they've been in barbershops, you know, for a long time. George Myers had a woman who was a manicurist in his barbershop. Zora Neale Hurston was a manicurist in a barbershop in D.C. to earn money to help pay for her schooling at Howard. And she writes about her work in a barbershop in D.C. And again, a barber, this is the 19-teens, 1917-18, a barber who George Robinson, I think was his name. He had a shop downtown near the Capitol that, again, only shaved white politicians. We also had a shop near the Shaw District that was particularly for black customers. And so Hurston sort of talks about her her time in that shop. So this image, I wanted to sort of use this image because it sort of captured a lot of things that I sort of unveil and explain further in the book.
It's very clear that barbershops changed the conversation. And what is amazing is that my mother owned a beauty parlor for 35 years in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I spent 10 years as a licensed cosmetologist working in that salon through high school and college. And I'm just thinking about the barbershop and the beauty parlor and the conversation that you're bringing to economics, right? Because as a young person in a beauty parlor, it did feel like it was community, but on a larger span, in a bigger study, in a cultural study of African Americans, it is about the money. It is the economy. Those are the things that keep us going. It's a business, right? Mm-hmm. And when you look at it very differently as a business, it changes the conversation of that space, mm-hmm. right? So it changes this conversation of that space, which can tell why this book is of most importance, mm-hmm. right? That we can look at something very differently. And it feels as though cutting along the color line does the thing of saying, we have been making money and making progress from and keeping businesses for ourselves across the timeline, and I think that's a wonderful thing. I love the idea of you explaining the little girl, because you're correct. I didn't know that that was a little girl when you first look at it, but it does make a change in this. The space of the barbershop, that women and men have been in this space for quite a while, mm-hmm. and it moves. And I also love how you move it from it's a business, and then it becomes political. You know, it becomes community based on the people, not on the space itself, So that's a wonderful thing. Why do you think people should read this book?
Because I wrote it? Is that enough?
That's good. I like that. I'm kidding. Pick it up and buy it.
Who am I? So. Somebody just turned the radio off. So I think folks should read this book for a few reasons. First, because I would argue that readers will think about their barbershop or barbershops in general differently, and that's a simple statement, and a simple goal that I had, but I think that we tend to underestimate the simple. And so there's a way in which much of the work of history is not assuming that things have always been a certain way, and asking the question, well, you know, how was it before and how has it changed? To then think about how is it changing, whatever the it is. And so in this case, right, how were barbershops, black barbershops situated in the 19th century? You know, how might I think about my current barbershop given that history? And where are barbershops going in the future? I think this book will sort of help provide some context and perspective. You know, in some ways, right? So again, I began this interview by talking about learning more about George Myers and you know, and his colleagues across the country who exclusively shaved white men, and you know, and there were tons of protests by African Americans who were like, "Yo, what what does this do for civil rights, right? If you know, we are, you know, fighting for the Civil Rights Act of 1875 and, you know, fighting to gain access. And yet we have these black barbers who won't even give access to black men to come in their shop." I mean, there was a huge conundrum and there was much debate and protest and conversation around this very practice. So let me just tell a quick story here to sort of get back to sort of why folks should read this book, because I think it illustrates some things that I, you know, if you think about why read the book, I also certainly have asked why write the book. I did some interviews, or I attempted to do my first set of interviews for this book. I went to Durham, North Carolina, and Atlanta, Georgia, to find, you know, black men who are either owned or worked in a barbershop anytime before 1970. And at the time, I had very long locks, dreadlocks, mm-hmm. That came maybe, you know, to the top of my waist. And I figured I would get some, you know, jokes from the barbers, of course. But I didn't expect the strong resistance to the interview. So, you know, many of those barbers, this is in 2003, said, you know, how does it look that you want to talk to me about barbering, but you haven't cut your hair and I don't know how long? Another barber said, you know, if we were depending on people like you, we would be out of business. You know, I would certainly point out that, well, you know, during the 50s and 60s, black folks had afros, and so they were coming to the barbershop less often. So you've sort of seen this before. And many of them, frankly, responded by saying, yeah, and that darn near put us out of business. Wow. Right? There's a way in which, you know, and so those rejections actually helped me sort of center the economy of the barbershop in ways that I hadn't before, right? So these were folks who were saying, look, you know, I need to make a living. The politics is great, the community is great, but I need to pay for school for my kids. I need to keep the shop open and pay rent and pay the lease and all this stuff. And so that helped me understand the George Myers of the 19th century and Alonzo Herndon in Atlanta and John Merrick in Durham, right? So all three sort of very prominent barbers in the late 19th century. There's a way in which I was resistant to understanding Myers, right? Like mm-hmm. my own politics, right, was getting in the way because, you know, it's like, well, who's this, you know, this dude who's selling out? And, you know, it's not shaving black men. Like, what's this about? And there's a way in which for some readers, right, that could be a distraction. But for me, right, I think that there's a way in which that sort of helps to though America has traditionally sort of touted the notion of meritocracy and, you know, business as this equalizer, right? So understanding freedom as market based, right? Meaning, you know, if one, you know, just, you know, worked hard, you know, they can certainly do well in America. There's a way in which this book indicates that when we put race in the story, it's not that simple, right? That the American dream, if there is such a thing, and the notion of a free market is not fully free, has never really been fully free, and that we had entrepreneurs who had to make decisions that alienated, you know, members of their own community in ways that these barbers didn't necessarily want to, but they knew that they had to in order to sort of make it, as they thought, make it in this industry. And so there's a way in which I think that readers should read this book, one, to understand the complications of that history, and to understand how barbershops, you know, like how, you know, barbers and barbershops sort of emerged, and the struggles, right, of barbers to emerge, to find space in cities and in communities, to have control and autonomy over their own spaces that would indeed lead to some autonomy within Black communities, right? And so, and this history, I would argue, would help readers think about the nature of barbershops today and in the future. And that's to say that there are many more unisex barbershops now than there were 50, 60, 70 years ago. And so the spaces themselves are much more visibly and frequently, routinely, I would say, spaces with men and women coming through in large numbers, right? So you have beauticians and barbers in the same space working together, men and women getting, you know, their hair done in the same space at the same time. Two, I think technology has changed social interactions largely. And it has changed barbershops as well. And so I don't frequent a whole lot of barbershops these days, but when I do, I certainly notice that men are on their cell phones a lot more, right? And so they are on Facebook, they're tweeting, you know, playing games. And so that face-to-face interaction isn't happening as often. It's certainly still happening, for sure. But technology is sort of mediating those interactions in barbershops. And so the nature of the spaces and the conversations in barbershops are certainly changing a bit. And third, again, with cities and Black communities becoming rapidly gentrified, you know, barbershops, Black barbershops are situated in such a way that they have to make decisions on whether or not, you know, they stay and try to court a new gentrified population, or if they leave and follow their clients who are moving to other parts of the city. Largely, I would certainly argue that, you know, for the most part, when Black people, at least with transportation, when they move out, they still go back to their same barber. They'll still go back to their same beautician and go back to their same church. But if they're moving quite, you know, far enough away that it costs a lot of money to get back, yeah, you know, twice a week, Saturday for a haircut, Sunday for church, then that would probably mean that they might be looking for a different church or a different barber that's closer to home. And so thinking about how barbers and barbershops are navigating our current landscape, right? There's a way in which thinking historically, right, and reading this book would help readers sort of understand their own, you know, their our contemporary moment. And so, you know, I think it's a good read. And plus, there aren't many works done on Black barbershops. I think there are a ton of books on Black beauty shops, but not barbershops. So I think this will give readers a different take on history, but also a wonderful context on our current world.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. This was wonderful. Of course, I just have to say it. Did the barbershop movie do your book justice? Can they go hand in hand?
Oh, jeez. You know, can they go hand in hand? In some ways, yes. I think that all of the barbershop movies have dealt with some aspect of economy, of generation, of entrepreneurship, of politics, of community, of history. I think that's in pretty much all of those barbershop films. I think, you know, the first one, which got into the, you know, the Rosa Parks deal, was probably a bit more interesting than the second and third. The third one, I wasn't sure why the third one was made. I don't know. It's after a while, you know, it's the kind of the same story.
Yes, correct.
But you sort of notice that with each of them, what makes the story is not even so much the barber. So there's usually two storylines. And again, I think, again, this is perfectly situates barbershops, black barbershops perfectly. There's usually a storyline about the business and a storyline about the community, right?
Yeah.
Both those storylines are in each of those three barbershop films. And I think that's a perfect way to think about these spaces, right? That, you know, you had Ice Cube's character, you know, hesitant about whether or not he wants to keep the barbershop. He wants to do something else. And then he certainly recognizes that, you know, this is a respectable business, right? That's important to local communities. And then you have the, you know, the politics around the community sort of seeping inside the shop and, you know, folks doing that work. And so you have competition. I think it was the second barbershop film where the franchise opened up across the street. Right. And so, you know, I think that those that at a sort of a base level, they do tackle many of those important issues. Spike Lee's, I'm going to shift from those three films. Spike Lee's master's thesis was titled Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop. So his film essentially was about barbershop. It was about a barbershop, and Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop is a student film that his master's thesis film that tackles again these same sort of themes of, you know, the owner of the shop. I believe he was murdered. Don't quote me on that, but I think he was murdered. And so then one of the barbers takes over the shop, gets involved in gambling to keep the shop afloat. You know, wants to sell the shop, and so it sort of gets into those questions of economy and community and how, you know, black businesses are situated in this case, how this shop was situated in Bed-Stuy. And so, yeah, I think, you know, any sort of barbershop film is going to tackle those things about economy, politics, and community in different ways. Coming to America, right, that barbershop scene with Eddie Murphy, you know, not a black barbershop, right? But barbershop scene nonetheless that, you know, still, again, so the nature of the conversations in the barbershop in the film reflected the folks who were in the shop, right? So Murphy was black and the barber was black. There was a Jewish, So Eddie Murphy was all of these characters, if I'm not mistaken. But he played a black barber, a white Jewish customer. I think there was another black customer in the shop, if I'm not mistaken. But I think the barbershop might have been owned by a black. It's been a while since I've seen it. But again, right, yet another example of both economy, community, and politics sort of converging to tell this narrative of this space. So, you know, interesting films. I think they're funny. The third one, probably less so. It's getting a little gimmicky. I think I heard either Ice Cube or I think it might have been Ice Cube say that, you know, these barbershop films can keep making them because there's always something to talk about in the barbershop, which I mean, yes, there's always something to talk about in the barbershop, but as a film, I think they need to do something radically different if they want to come out with a fourth one, because they're all starting to feel the same. And so, you know, I'm no screenwriter, but you know.
But you know, exactly. But you know, you know, the barbershop.
I know the barbershop. You know, I watch movies.
He knows the barbershop and he watches movies. This was absolutely great. I am most appreciative of you coming and sharing this new conversation about the barbershop and adding a different dimension about barbershops to it. And barbershops are important.
Yeah.
Plain and simple to the Black culture, right? So excellent. Is there anything you'd like to add to this conversation that we may not have talked about, something that you want the listeners to know? Or if you were to write a number two book, you know, is there something new you're working on?
So if I were to, interesting. So if I were to write another book related to barbers or barbershops, I would do a lot more digging on women. Like it would actually be women in barbershops. Like it would be focused on. So I do talk about a few women who were barbers in the 1920s and 1930s. But it's not enough. And so if I were, I'm not working on that, but if I were to write a sort of follow up, it would be focused on women and Black women, and barbershops. So women who were barbers, who were manicurists, women who, you know, got their afros trimmed there, who got their bobs done in the 1920s and 30s, right? I would do that. I'm currently working on two books. One is on civil rights fundraising. And so, in looking at oral histories and doing oral histories of my own, Black barbers in the 1950s and 60s would talk about how they felt free to openly contribute to civil rights campaigns because they were not beholden to a white employer and they were not beholden to white customers. They felt a sense of economic security as business owners, but also, again, as independent workers, even those who didn't own a barbershop but just were barbers in a shop, they still had some sense of economic independence. They felt open and free to contribute money to civil rights campaigns or to sign petitions. And that those few – so that was a big deal. And then Black beauticians have said the same thing, right? So that little instance sort of raised a question for me of, oh, so how was the civil rights and Black power movements financed, right? Where did folks get money to bail all those folks out of jail? Where did all these funds come from, et cetera? And so that's one book I'm working on. I'm looking at the flow of money, during, the civil rights and Black power movements. And so the other book that I'm working on that's related, again, comes out of this now second book, actually, but I'm working on them at the same time, is a history of bail in America.
Oh.
And so there's currently a large movement to reform bail. As we know, Andre Browder in New York, right, who was arrested and I'm forgetting the charge he was arrested for, but he couldn't afford bail, and so he had to sit in jail to await his trial, and he waited in jail for 3 years.
Oh my!
Right, and as we all know, jail does not rehabilitate anybody. It actually creates. Can create monsters, if you will. And Browder had a difficult time in jail. He was abused. He was beat. He was constantly in fights because he was trying to survive. And when he got – after 3 years, the charges were dropped. And then he was, he was released from jail. And he just couldn't make it, and he wound up committing suicide. And this all stemmed from him not being able to afford the freaking bail. And there are many, many people who cannot afford bail. And obviously, if you're wealthy enough, you can afford the bail and you don't have to sit in jail to wait to await your trial. And so thinking about, again, you know, Martin Luther King, SNCC, the Black Panthers, they all raised money in order to have money on hand for bail. And so I am interested in doing a larger history of bail and how it's historically been situated in pretrial jurisprudence. So that's what I'm – those are the two books that I'm currently working on.
And I they're great. So when they're out there, we're going to have you back because they go hand in hand.
Right? Absolutely.
They do go hand in hand. It's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Angela. This has been really great conversation, great questions. Yes. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely, Quincy. Absolutely. So you enjoy the rest of your spring break.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we will talk again.
Absolutely. Take care.
Bye-bye.